Ready to proceed?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Louis Rizzo. I represent Handler Corporation and Handler Development in this appeal. I'm prepared to give the Court a brief recitation of the facts in this case, unless the Court would prefer that I proceed to our...
We've all read the briefs, and we're thoroughly familiar with the facts.
Very well, Your Honor. This case, as the Court then knows, involves a construction site injury, and construction claims uniquely involve the intersection, if you will, of premises law liability and construction law liability. And I say uniquely because many of the courts, when confronting these issues, have struggled with the reconciliation of these two, at times divergent, doctrines of law. And the reason for that is articulated very well for us at page 25 of the plaintiff's, the appellee's brief, when they point out that at a construction site, there are dangerous areas around which employees must work. And so with that as a starting point, these competing doctrines, at times competing doctrines of premises liability law and construction liability law must be reconciled in each case. In this case, the trial court, in that sort of struggle of these two competing doctrines, drew concepts from each area of those of law, and in doing so formulated a new standard that is in conflict with both areas of the law. That new standard formulated by the trial court constitutes legal error, which should be reversed.
Where do we go to find the analysis she used for the construct of the new standard?
Unfortunately, the standard was articulated in a ruling from the bench, and we attached to our briefs as exhibits A and B the transcripts of the two court proceedings at which the court discussed and articulated that ruling.
So neither side argued for this new rule.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, I asked the same question. Where do I go to find the analysis that supports the new standard?
The analysis, I would suggest to the court, can be found in two places. First of all, the oral argument on summary judgment, the transcript of that is attached, I believe, as Exhibit A to appellee's answering brief. Exhibit B to our opening brief contains the colloquy on the jury instructions at the prayer conference during trial, which again delved into that standard and how it would be articulated in the form of a legal instruction to the jury.
Has any other court in any state or federal jurisdiction adopted a similar rule?
We're aware of none, Your Honor. This is an issue of first impression, not only here in Delaware, but as far as we can tell, in the area of construction law nationwide.
What makes it an issue of first impression, other than the fact that the trial judge articulated a different standard?
That's it. That it had never been identified or articulated as...
When I ask the question about the analysis, what I'm looking for are the whys and the wherefores of the need for a newly articulated standard that is apparently unsupported in the record by any case law, any law review article, or any treatise.
I agree, Your Honor, and unfortunately, the best I can tell you is that the court's new standard was prompted by the trial court's concern over what it deemed to be in public policy considerations.
And where are they articulated in the record?
In the oral argument for summary judgment, which appears at Exhibit A of plaintiff's appellee's answering brief.
And they are articulated by whom?
By the court in essentially the questioning during oral argument.
So if I wanted to find the analysis that the court used to develop a new standard of law, apart from any citations to support it, I would simply go to the question she asked at oral argument.
That's
correct. Is that where I'm left?
Unfortunately, yes, Your Honor. We did not file a motion for a new trial, and so no subsequent opinion in response to that was generated. Rather, we took our appeal directly from following trial.
Now, the briefs suggest that your opponent's brief suggests that even though this might have been a new standard, it was close enough to what we'd call the existing law that an application of a new standard, if it was error, would have been harmless. So, and remind us of your position.
Unfortunately, it's irreconcilable, Your Honor, with both the traditional and longstanding rule on for construction law liability as well as existing premises law liability. This court in the Emery Hill case gave us a very clear framework for the analysis. In Emery Hill, this court stated that to the extent a risk, the risk at issue in the construction site injury was inherent in the work, what some of the earlier cases had called a hazard attendant to the work being performed under the contract, in such an instance, we would look to the active control doctrine as that's been developed through case law. If it's not inherent in the work, as the court found it to be, for example, in the Emery Hill case, then we would look to the traditional premises law doctrines. The court's new standard, the trial court's new standard, draws elements from both of those and creates a situation where a general contractor could be liable under this new standard, where that same general contractor, under either the application of the traditional premises law liability or construction law liability, would not be liable. And so they are not reconcilable, Your Honor.
Well, after she ruled the way she did on summary judgment, she didn't have any real choice but to develop a new standard to get around her own summary judgment ruling. Isn't that correct?
That was the only way, Your Honor, because the record was abundantly clear that under the traditional active control doctrine, there was no active control over the manner and method of work of the subcontractor, no voluntary assumption of job site safety, no control over the work area, any of the elements developed through the case law and the active control doctrine, and as such.
Well, what about the voluntary assumption of a duty to ensure safety? There was evidence of that at trial, was there not?
Your Honor, the evidence, the factors that can be pointed to in the record, even if we're to include the record at trial, fall so significantly short.
Well, it's the verdict which is at issue here, isn't it? So we have to look at the record at trial, don't we?
The court is free to include and should examine the record at trial as well. And even doing so, Your Honor, the factors that can be pointed to support a contention that there was a voluntary assumption of job site safety fall so well short of even those cases that found there to be no voluntary assumption of job site safety. We're talking about cases like the Bryant case, cases like the Raybar case, which found in each of those cases had significantly, that the general contractor had actively injected themselves into that safety process by hiring safety consultants
well,
who would
there,
train the subcontractor.
Weren't there admissions by your superintendent that there was a duty to do certain things, safety related?
Well, what the handler employees said was if they visibly saw something that was a dangerous condition, they would either have the subcontractor correct it or take some other corrective measure. That precise issue has been addressed and found lacking when applying this analysis of voluntary assumption of job site safety or active control. It's not a meaningful, what the courts have identified as a meaningful active control over the actual means and methods and the training, equipping, and supervision of the safety for these subcontractors.
Well, would it be an unfair reading of the record to suggest that there's evidence from your own employees, your past and then present superintendent, that as a part of their job on the site, they routinely looked for safety problems and corrected them when they found them?
Well,
and that there was on the premises of the house where the incident occurred sufficient equipment that could have protected the scaffold or could have put up a protective rail at the scaffold that might have prevented the accident?
Well, there's two parts to that question, Your Honor. It is absolutely correct that there was equipment on site to allow the plaintiff to work at heights. This plaintiff and his coworkers and employer had worked in this very same home the day before and had worked at heights higher than this ceiling and had used equipment. The testimony suggests there was ladder, scaffolds, extension poles that were on site that allowed them to work at heights. All that equipment was the plaintiff's employer's equipment, not my client's. My client did not supply any materials, tools, or equipment to the plaintiff or his coworkers. That's an important component in the analysis of active control or voluntary assumption. The second part of
it. Was it the plaintiff's employer or another subcontractor that provided the scaffolding?
Well, that's disputed. But what's clear is that my client did not provide that scaffolding. There was testimony from witnesses that observed scaffolding on the date of the incident, and plaintiff and his coworkers were the only contractor in the job, as is typical practice, on the date of the incident.
Where did the scaffolding come from that was erected, or the railing come from that was erected after the fall?
After the fall, my client directed that a temporary railing be installed, and I believe that was installed by a framing subcontractor, separate subcontractor.
Well, doesn't that go to your client's assumption, voluntary assumption of a duty to ensure safety on the job site?
No, Your Honor, it doesn't. Once again, the reaction to an observed and acknowledged safety condition. In other words, my client now knew that this plaintiff and his coworkers were not using the fall protection means at their disposal, and so now needed to go in and put those railings up since that obviously did not happen. And that's been addressed, for example, in some of the prior cases, Bryant and Raybar, where the general contractors not only retained authority to shut the job down or kick a subcontractor off the job site or point out and correct errors that it observed and direct that they be corrected, still was not involving itself, injecting itself into the process, falls well short of that required assumption, the required level of involvement to be deemed to be assumption of job site safety.
Are you saying the railings were put up for the first time after the accident, or is there a situation where the railings were down during the accident and were put back up?
Yes. Justice Ridgely asked about the re-erection of railings. They were originally erected at the time of framing by the framing contractor. They're nailed to the framing members. They need to be removed so that the drywall can be installed and painted before the permanent rails are then affixed.
And who directed that be done?
The original erection of the rails,
right.
That was part of the subcontract with the framing subcontractor.
So it's in the agreement that shall erect rails?
Part of the job specifications included erection of temporary rails. So that was part of the framing subcontractor specification.
At any time that the painters and the employees of the painting subcontractor, including the plaintiff in this case, were they ever on the scaffolding painting when there were protective rails?
Their testimony in the record was that not in this particular unit where the incident occurred, if that's what Your Honor is asking. If you're talking about in general, at times they had worked in conditions at this project, other projects with other general contractors where there are temporary railings in place or not in place. And it was dependent upon the phase of construction and the specifics of that job. With the framework that we're provided in the Emery Hill case, we look at the question of, is this something that's an inherent risk in the work being performed? The plaintiff, in this case a painter, falling from heights. We know that this is a risk inherent in his work because common sense tells us so, that painters who are contracted to paint at heights, contracted to paint in a home with 20-foot ceilings, are going to be working at heights, and that's a hazard that they need to recognize and guard against. And therefore, it's inherent in the risk. We also know it from the analysis that's provided in cases like Rafferty and cases like in Re Asbestos Roca. In that case, although the court's discussing a different doctrine, one of the elements of that doctrine is a risk inherent in the work, and the example that the court cites is a painter falling from heights. And in fact, that example is drawn from the illustration from the Restatement Section 427, which gives that as one of its illustrations of a risk inherent in the work, a painter falling from heights.
It may be out of place, and I may not understand it, because it, after all, is an email ruling. But in the trial judge's email statement of what she was going to do and why, immediately after setting her new standard, she cites the Rafferty case. Could she have meant that Rafferty in some way supports this new articulation of her standard?
I don't see how that would be possible, Your Honor, because Rafferty never even engaged in the analysis of a premises law liability, which you only get to under the Emery Hill and Cini analysis. You only get to when you find it to be not inherent in the work. So clearly she concluded this was inherent in the work, and Rafferty, their sole analysis was on the active control doctrine and found it, like this case, to be lacking.
You're in your rebuttal. Do you want to save the balance of your time?
I would, unless the court has any further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Morning, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. May it please the court. No new exemption, no new exception is either necessary or warranted. In this case, should be affirmed. Let me relate to the court what I mean by that. In the Emery Hill case, which has been cited several times, this court stated that if a particular danger and risk is not inherent in the worker's job, then the active control exemption, what Judge Walsh called it, the exemption, doesn't apply. Then the plaintiff would have to prove liability, causation, proximate cause, and damages, along with proving that it was inherent. That was really all we needed to prove. The court in this case wrestled with the idea of assumption of responsibility, and it finally came out, in not the most optimal way, but did finally come out with the idea that there was an issue of fact as to assumption of responsibility. We're going to give that to the jury. In fact, the plaintiff had to prove more than what this court has told us we would have to prove under Emery. And let me go on. Under Emery, we would have had to prove that the painter falling from this particular platform was not inherent in his job, and then go on to liability and causation. But we had to prove three things under this standard. We had to prove that the problem was open and obvious, and that it affected more than one employer, or more than one employer's employees, and that it wasn't inherent. Given the quantum and quality of evidence we had in the case, it didn't much bother us, to be honest with you, because the evidence was overwhelming. But in that case, we proved, the trial judge said, that is an issue that I think has been fairly raised, and everyone knew about it, and that we're going to submit it to a jury. So not only did we convince a judge that it should have been sent to a jury, but we had a unanimous jury decide that this particular fall was not inherent in his job. It happens to be consistent with the case law. If you look at the Emery Hill case, it's consistent with that case. Rafferty, it's absolutely consistent with Rafferty.
There was a special interrogatory on that?
No, there was a specific instruction, Your Honor, on that. The instruction went, you may only find the defendant liable if you find all three of these items to be found beyond the reason by preponderance of the evidence. All three of these things, open and obvious, affected multiple employers, and was not inherent in his inherent in his job. We have a unanimous verdict that it wasn't inherent. Now, I would say to the court, what particular issue is the issue of inherence, or as the courts have said, I don't know if it's a word, uninherence, is case by case. It's a very factually driven matter. And when you look at the facts, the judge decided that she was going to give that to the jury. That's not inappropriate at all. Whether something's inherent in somebody's job is not something that specifically a legal issue that a trial judge has some type of superior knowledge of. This is a factually driven issue.
Tell me what the instruction under Emery, how it would have read.
The instruction under Emery would have read that in order to find duty on the part of the general contractor, you need to find, by a preponderance of the evidence, that the danger involved in this case and the injury involved in this case was not inherent to the to the worker's job. In other words, and I think if you look at the instruction in this case, in other words, it wasn't specific as to that particular employee, which is taken right out of the case law, by the way.
So there's no pattern instruction?
No, sir. There's no pattern instruction on this. And, in fact, the defendants didn't want an instruction on control. They rejected it, and the court went along with that. The court said, we have an assumption of risk, assumption of responsibility issue here, and I'm going to submit that issue to the jury. I grant you, Justices, that at the end of the summary judgment argument, there were comments made, I want to put this new standard in. But when you really examine this standard after the cases and before the jury gets the case, what Her Honor said was that, okay, now I've heard everything, which is perfectly acceptable, by the way. Now I've heard everything. I'm going to be instructing on essentially on assumption of responsibility, but I'm going to make plaintiff reach three different items that she instructed. Now, where do those items, as Mr. Chief Justice, you've mentioned, where do those items come from? They come right from the case law. If you look at the open and obvious standard, you see that mentioned all over. If you look for the second standard of multiple affecting multiple employers, it's in Raybar, it's in Hawthorne. If you look at the third element of adherence, it's obviously in Embry Hill, but it's also in the Leonard versus Coffin case. And that's an interesting case because a trial judge in that case ruled that a drywaller walking around a construction site who falls into an open elevator shaft, that's not inherent in his job because everybody can fall at a construction site. The facts of this case show us that we had multiple subcontractors and employees who were at risk to fall. That wasn't inherent. We're not talking about an electrician crossing a wire. I think it's important to look at the case law that the trial court initially struggled with, but we maintain got right, not under some new concept of policy, but under existing case law. If you look at the case law, you can look at every one of these cases, as I'm sure we all have, and if you listen to the facts, you'll know whether there should be a duty. I'm not saying it's result-oriented, but it's factually oriented. Judge Del Pesco said in Figs, said, you know, the fact that an injury happens on a work site does not, as she says, does not insulate a tortfeasor from liability. She said that if a party unreasonably fails to prevent an accident that they could have prevented, they'd be held liable. And if you look at the case law, that's where it comes out. All the judges who have talked about this kind of, is there a duty? That's the issue here. We can talk about all these doctrines, but did the general contractor have a duty? When you look at the case law, it's factually driven. Some examples. In Figs, we have unprotected staircases. They said, yeah, you should have seen those staircases. It was another subcontractor. You should have protected against that. In Hawthorne, you have a fall where OSHA requirements, just like here, where OSHA requirements weren't being maintained.
Can you articulate for me what the duty the general contractor had on the specifics of this case?
Yes, sir, I can.
What is it?
The duty of the general contractor was to note an obvious safety hazard that had been around for 9 or 10 days that subjected multiple employees of multiple contractors, including the general contractor and the owner of the lot, to a substantial danger. And they had a duty to do what they did in the first place. This is a general contractor who directs a subcontractor, put a railing up because we don't want people to fall. This is the same general contractor who, as soon as someone does fall, says, put a railing up because we don't want any more people to fall. This is a general contractor who we have, and you won't find, I will contend, you will not find this quantum or quality of evidence in any case that exists in Delaware, and that is this. One, we have this railings before and railings after, directed by the general contractor. Two, we have every site superintendent who was on the site who testified that I had a duty as part of my job as site superintendent to make sure that those railings stayed up, and if I saw they were down, it was my duty to put them back up.
Well, maybe I'm confused about what active control means, but how is that consistent with a summary judgment ruling that there are no genuine issue of material fact about the general contractor having active control, I assume, over the scaffolding where this accident occurred?
No scaffolding, Your Honor. We're talking about a safety rail. There was no scaffolding involved in this, but I'm not talking about active control. I'm talking about assumption of responsibility for that particular safety hazard. In this case, they assumed responsibility for this particular safety hazard, and they failed. How do we know that they assumed that responsibility?
What does active control mean?
Active control. We maintain that the trial judge was wrong in terms of a ruling of active control, but we don't think it's relevant in this case, and it's not relevant for this purpose. As this court instructed in Emory Hill, if the danger is not inherent in the particular work, then active control is irrelevant. As Judge Welsh said in Emory Hill, the active control exemption, as he called it, is no longer relevant once you have an injury that is not inherent. The appellants in this case want you to be able to say that in these cases, in the facts of these cases, they had no duty. This is all about duty. You can get the duty by active control. You can get the duty by acceptance of responsibility. And in this case, we maintain, if you look at all the case law, it's fact-driven. For example, in the figs, I mentioned the unprotected stairs. The case is on the other side, Sweeney and Williams. A general contractor hires someone to dig a trench. The trench falls in on the general on those employees. Should the general contractor be held liable under that circumstance? No. You have the Bryant case. You have a floating crane. The employer owns the crane. The plaintiff operates the crane. They try to lift something that's too heavy. The crane falls over. Should the general contractor be held liable in that case? No.
Was there any factual dispute in this case about acceptance of responsibility?
Oh, sure. No. I don't believe there are any facts which show anything but acceptance of responsibility.
Was there testimony one way and testimony the other way?
Oh, absolutely. There was testimony. This is not our job. Essentially, the testimony at trial was that we're not responsible for this. And that's – I'm sorry.
So was the jury instructed about the relevance of acceptance of responsibility and what they needed to find in order to impose liability on that basis?
Yes, sir. Remember, at first, the first instruction that was in order for them to show duty or show responsibility, it wasn't framed in terms of assumption of responsibility, but it was framed in terms of if you have a hazard, the plaintiff has to show three things in order for you to even examine negligence and proximate cause. And those three things were that it was open and obvious, that affected other employers, and that it was not inherent in the work. All those taken directly from Delaware case law, and not a new standard, by the way.
Do you have those three factors without an acceptance of responsibility?
No, I don't see how you could have those three factors. Those three factors were simply an expression of what would make up responsibility, acceptance of responsibility. Frankly, we shouldn't under Delaware law have had to prove all three of those, but we did. We had the employees who were there saying that it was their duty. We had their own experts.
You're going to have to help me through this. I'm missing Please. How those three factors necessarily follows how proving those three factors proves acceptance of responsibility, which is a basis for legal liability.
Now, it proves acceptance of responsibility according to the case law. In the first instance, in that under Emory Hill, if only the third element is present, duty can apply, and then you go to issues of negligence. I think we cannot forget the fact that even with these three items that we had to prove, that the next thing that the plaintiff has to prove is negligence. Now, we have to prove negligence from the standpoint of, did they assume responsibility? That was argued by both sides. We argued it based on the facts. And based
well,
on
is assumption of responsibility, assumption of a duty, or is it evidence of negligence?
Duty, Your Honor. It's duty. Assumption of responsibility is duty. All of this is about duty. And if you look at the Delaware case law in this area, as Judge Del Pesco and some other, and frankly as Judge Welsh talked about, this is an issue of trying to find duty, seeing whether it is reasonable under the facts to apply duty. All of the case law says that. Is it reasonable under Delaware law to apply duty? The court in this case said it will only be reasonable to apply duty if they met these three standards. Frankly, if we could have met any one of them under Delaware case law, we then go to negligence, and we had to argue negligence.
Let me shift for a minute to negligence, and one of my concerns is, can you reconcile for me the judge's rulings on why evidence of alcohol consumption by the plaintiff was inadmissible, but evidence of alcohol consumption by the superintendent on the job was admissible, and how evidence of consumption of alcohol by the superintendent directly related to this accident?
Yes, sir, I can. In the first instance, I would note that the defendants have not chosen to appeal the judge's order on that issue. But to answer your question specifically, there was a note in an emergency room record that stated that someone had had a couple of beers, and they were relating that to my client. The person who wrote that was not available at trial. They were going to try to prove it by a record. My client, at the time of that, did not speak English. My client now does speak English. It was highly speculative as to whether he ever said that, and to whether and to who, and the person who wrote it down wasn't there to testify. Now that's different from.
So the medical record did not indicate that he said he had had a couple of beers that day.
I'm trying to remember the exact phrasing of it, Your Honor.
You suggested to me that the medical record might not have reflected that that was a comment made by the plaintiff.
The medical record.
That someone had a couple of beers is what you said.
I'm sorry. Someone had reported that the plaintiff may have had a couple of beers.
Or that the plaintiff said he had a couple of beers is what I'm trying to get a handle on.
I'm not sure which way it went, but I also know that there was a blood test done and he had no alcohol in him.
What was the basis for excluding that record?
In that it was not relevant to what happened in the accident. And at the end that it was speculative, and that the person who wrote it down was not present to testify as to exactly who told him what. It was hearsay. Who told him what, under what circumstances?
Well, I understand it was hearsay.
But no, it was double hearsay. It was said by someone else.
Well, that's why I asked the specific question. Was it
a double hearsay,
medical record made for the purpose of treating the plaintiff or taking a history that the plaintiff said he had a couple of beers that day? That was my question. You may have answered it.
I hope I did. It was hearsay, Your Honor. Not only from the record standpoint, but from the standpoint of the person who wrote it.
All medical records are hearsay. I understand that.
No, double hearsay, Your Honor. I want to make sure that's clear.
Okay.
That the person who was reporting that was not available. Right. They didn't know who that was either.
What is the direct relationship between testimony that the superintendent consumed alcohol and the absence of the rail on the day of the accident?
A dangerous site superintendent, a drinking site superintendent is a dangerous site superintendent. You can't take the drinking and keep it by itself, as this court has instructed us in the past. This was a.
Was there evidence he drank on the day of the accident, and that directly resulted in no rail being put up?
No, Your Honor.
Or no, whatever the.
Absolutely not, Mr. Chief Justice.
This was. Why was it admitted?
It was admitted because this was a continuing issue of negligence. The rails were down for 9 or 10 days. They should have been put up at any point during that time. And it was continuing negligence not to put them up. Everyone who walked into this house looked up. And
assuming that's true, what was the evidence that the failure to put up the rails directly resulted from the fact that the superintendent consumed alcohol?
The evidence was relevant to show that the site superintendent was negligent in many and all of his duties. When you walked into that house, and this is somewhat important, we think, when you walked into that house, there was no chance that you couldn't have seen those rails were up. Everyone was in there, so you had to have seen it. Mr. Dugan testified in the first instance that the rails were up at his deposition. At trial, he said, I don't know whether they were up. What we contended was that his drinking and his other incompetent behavior, of which there was significant testimony, that he was drinking on a regular basis prior to this fall, that he was irrational, that he was slurring his speech, that he was...
And you're talking about on the day of the...
No, I'm talking about the period before the fall. We don't have it on the day, Your Honor, but frankly, we don't need it on the day, in that this was a continuing course. He should have had those rails up on the 9th day. Then he should have had them on the 8th day and the 7th day and so on. So this testimony was relevant and very important to show that.
No, I understand. You don't need to convince me of why it was important to you and what you wanted to use it to show. I was trying to get how it directly resulted in the accident, and I think you've answered it sufficiently. The second evidentiary question I have is the medical bill testimony.
Yes, sir.
Why was
the expert witness's testimony about the value of future medical services in Mexico not admitted?
Well, it was not offered. There was no offer of the medical testimony regarding. There was no offer at summary judgment. There was no offer on the motions in limine. There was never an offer. There has never been any testimony that you that a wheelchair in Mexico costs more or less than a wheelchair in the United States.
All right, then I must have misread the record, because I thought there was evidence on your part that the plaintiff would incur medical expenses in the United States for the next 50 years, and that evidence that it was as likely that he would incur medical expenses for all or part of that time in Mexico, and that they were much less expensive, was offered. If that was not, then I don't have a
question. It was not offered, Your Honor. I'm sure of that. To sum up, Your Honor, this is not a new standard. These are cases. These are matters. Everything that the trial judge did in terms of instructing the jury, and that is really the crux of the case. Was the jury properly instructed on duty? They were. The jury was instructed. To accept appellant's theory of this case, you have to accept the fact that they have no duty under circumstances in which there's an open and obvious safety hazard for a 9 to 10 day period. That they had ordered prior to this that the rails be put up. That they told 16 days prior to this, that they told their own employees, be careful, you have to make sure the safety rails are up to protect yourself and everyone else on the site. And you have to make sure you do that. And then they can, under their theory, hire an incompetent and inebriated site supervisor. I'm sorry, it's not political assassination here, but they hire those people, and they say, well, that's okay. You don't have a duty.
Thank you, Mr. Dole.
Thank you, Mr. Justice.
Your Honors, plaintiffs contending today that the risk of falling, pain or falling, is not inherent in his work. Let's proceed from that premise and follow the analysis from the Emory Hill case. If it's not inherent in the work, then we go to premises liability law, not construction law, and we say, is it open and obvious? We just heard from counsel that it is, and that's obvious in the record as well. And so when a situation is open and obvious under premises liability law, the owner or general contractor has no obligation to warn or correct. Under 343 of the restatement of 343 Cap A, and that's what's discussed in Cini, and the Supreme Court has addressed it and confirmed it as a identifying a duty in the Cota Forest case. And that standard, that duty, does not exist under a premises liability analysis where there's an open and obvious hazard. If we follow the Emory Hill analysis and accept plaintiff's contention that it's not a risk inherent in painting, it's an open and obvious hazard under 343 Cap A, there's no duty. So it is impossible to say that this new standard, and it is a new standard, is just a restatement of what the existing law is. It's contrary to both premises liability law and construction liability law. In response to the notion that the plaintiff has asserted in response to questions from Justice Ridgely that there was instruction on a voluntary assumption of job site safety. It's incorrect. There was no such instruction. There was no such instruction because summary judgment was granted on that issue. Summary judgment was granted on the assumption of job site safety, active control over manner and method, and control over the work area based on the undisputed facts in the record. And as such, no instructions were given on that.
But evidence was presented both ways on that.
Well, Your Honor, while evidence which was presented for other purposes may have touched on that, no one presented evidence since those issues were in the case, were not in the case, excuse me. We did not present evidence to attempt to prove or disprove those concepts, neither party. While some of the evidence that came in for other purposes may have touched on it, and so because it wasn't instructed, because it wasn't going to be in the case, it wasn't argued, and there wasn't specific evidence presented to prove or disprove it by either side. The only evidence, the duty that the jury was going to be instructed on, the sole issue, was this new standard. Briefly, with respect to the court's questions on the alcohol and the medical record. The medical record specifically attributed a statement to the plaintiff which said that he had consumed two beers and had nothing else to eat from 8:30 that morning. It was specific as to date, time, and amount of consumption, and related specifically to this date of this incident. The court, in addition to the hearsay analysis, went on to say that under a 403 relevancy balancing test, it was too speculative as to, so as to, that speculative nature was, did not allow with any probative effect on overcome what it acknowledged was significantly prejudicial evidence, and so it excluded it. That same analysis, if it would be applied correctly to the evidence, the vague and general statements about people's lay impressions and beliefs about his the superintendent's alcohol consumption, should have served to exclude that highly inflammatory. And what we heard today was the real purpose of why it was admitted. I see my time is up. I would simply incorporate all of our arguments that is contained in our briefs on all the issues.
Thank you. Thank you very much, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.
Please rise.